now with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved. Here is Dr. James Houck.
Well, good afternoon, everybody, wherever you are in the world at this time, whether you are Eastern Standard Time, Central Standard Time, Mountain or Pacific, wherever you are, even beyond, welcome. You are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, helping you find your courage to reclaim that which has always been in you. And if you have been following me for some time, you know that I am right here on BBS Radio, and every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. But if you're on the West Coast, that's noon Pacific Standard Time. So each and every week, these broadcasts focus on the integration of spirituality and our mental health. And I place this integration all within the context of our relationships, relationships that we have with ourself or intrapersonal, relationships that we have with others or interpersonal, and relationships that we have with God or the divine, definitely spiritual. And you are in for a treat today because I'm going to be talking about the spiritual side of emotional intelligence and how we live in that sacred neutral. And the whole reason why I place this integration in relationships as the foundation, or if you want to use another terminology, the common denominator, it's because when we think about it, how many of us out there have received our deepest physical, emotional, psychological, even spiritual wounds in and through relationships? And yet, here's the irony. We can also discover our greatest healing and strength and peace and forgiveness and love through healthier relationships. And of course, we don't have to really overthink it because we just look at the relationships that we have in our lives, the relationships within our own families, relationships we have with our coworkers and friends, wherever. Because whenever we find ourselves being in the midst of transformation, we also transform others through our presence, through the grace that has been shown to us, and certainly our understanding. But first, forgiveness, kindness, and compassion begins with how we treat ourselves. And this is certainly the key, something I've been kicking around probably the past year. I'm gonna write a book. Hold me to this, okay? If you don't see it coming by the end of summer, shoot me a line or something. I want to get it out there and get it done because I've been thinking about this, and the more I think about it, the more, the stronger it's been coming in. And this is this whole notion of self-inflicted wounds. And I'm approaching it from this understanding of, being in relationships and how we oftentimes experience our greatest wounds in relationships. But through healthier relationships, we can experience our greatest sense of healing as well. But often how we treat one another keeps ourselves wounded. So when I say, forgiveness, kindness, compassion begins with how we treat ourselves, this is what I have in mind. Because whenever we are compassionate with ourselves, we can certainly then become compassionate with others. And when we are forgiving of ourselves, we can certainly then be more forgiving with others. And when we are able to live in this gratitude, just living it out on a daily basis, just being thankful for everything that we have, and we're able to live in that place of gratitude with ourselves, we then discover how this opens our hearts to see and to live in gratitude in relationships with others. So transformation, first and foremost, certainly begins with us. Well, one of my favorite psychologists out there, Carl Rogers, I love the theory on person-centered therapy and, you know, or client-centered therapy as well. He just had a way about him. Everybody tries to emulate Rogers and, you know, what was his technique? How did he do it? And so forth. And when you understand Rogers' writings, or if you happen to see any films on him, you realize that he was the technique. He, you know, developed it into his own theory, but he was the technique, just how he sat with people, how he understood people, and where he was coming from with that, and just why and how he worked with people the way that he did. And so one of his, you know, just more famous quotes that just really connect with me over and over again is this one. It comes right out of his book, Person-Centered Therapy. And he says, when the other person is hurting, or when the other person is confused, or troubled, or anxious, or alienated, or terrified, or when he or she is doubtful of self-worth, or uncertain as to their identity, then understanding is called for. This gentle and sensitive companionship of an empathic stance provides illumination and healing. In such situations, deep understanding is, I believe, the most precious gift one can give to another. Okay, so like I said, that's one of my favorite quotes from Carl Rogers. But let's look at this quote a little bit deeper. How do we do this? You know, like how do we live this out? You know, if Carl Rogers was the technique, so to speak, what changes did occur in him and so forth? How did he get to a place where he just valued everybody and he valued everything that was in everybody? And he worked with others to let's go find the very best parts of you. Okay, so how do we do this? And this is kind of what this show is all about here, helping you discover how to reclaim those things or that which has always been in you. You know, those very good things that you've already come into this world with. But sometimes we go through things and they just overshadow, that we tend to forget, or we minimize it. And we just say, no, I don't think so. I don't think I have anything to offer anybody. And we start to label ourselves as a loser, or, you know, we're no good, or whatever other message we heard growing up. And we go through life then from a place of woundedness, instead of finding the healing in through healthier relationships. And then we can live and be in relationship with others from a place of healing and wholeness. And we can embrace our hachetas, our uniqueness. And we're able to do that in ourselves. We're able to do that for others. We're able to embrace their wholeness and their uniqueness, to value and appreciate them. Well, I'm Dr. James Houck, and if you would like more information about me, or if you would like to leave me your comments about today's show, I invite you to visit the website. The address is www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. Okay, so www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. And these broadcasts are also podcasted, in case you want to go back and listen again, or if you want to go back into the archives and catch up on the previous shows that you had missed. And if you would like to call in and be part of today's show, I invite you to call the toll-free line, 888-627-6008, and give me your insights, your comments and thoughts on today's subject, living in the sacred neutral, the spiritual side of emotional intelligence. Well, got a question for you, as I love to start out these broadcasts every week with a question just to get you on board and get you thinking and so forth. But how many of you out there in internet radio land have ever taken an IQ test? Okay. Have you ever taken an IQ test? Now, it could have been one that you have taken online, Or let's say you went down the more traditional route of the paper and pencil test. But either way, you wanted to know just how smart you are. Okay? And the questions were a little tricky. Okay? Well, more than likely, the IQ test you took was based on the original test that was developed by Alfred Binet. And according to the stories, Binet was asked by the French government during the early 1900s, and he was approached by them to help decide which students were most likely to experience difficulty in school. And the reason why they approached him is because the government had passed laws requiring that all French children attend school. So it was important for them to find a way to identify children who would need, as they put it, specialized assistance. Okay. So Binet and his colleague, Theodore Simon, began to develop these questions that focused on areas not explicitly taught in the schools. And so there are questions focused on attention, memory, and problem-solving skills. And depending on how the questions were answered, Binet was able to determine which ones served as the best predictors of school success. And he quickly realized that some children were able to answer the more advanced questions than older children who are generally able to answer that, and vice versa. Okay, and based on this simple observation, Binet suggested this concept of a mental age, or a measurement of intelligence based on the average abilities of children of a certain age group. And he came up with this formula, and it's very simple once you have it. And this is why it's easy to get your, you know, IQ score. And he said you take a person's mental age, and that is how they scored on the test, okay? And then you divide it by a person's chronological age. All right, you get a number, and then you multiply that by 100, and then that gives you your intelligence quotient, or your IQ. And then, you know, you go to the chart, and you see exactly where you are, and then you call up your friends with your IQ score, and you say, hey, guess what I did? I scored 100 and whatever, or I scored 80, or I scored 90-something, you know. And we just wanted to, you know, check in with our friends to see, you know, who of us is so-called smarter. Well, since that time, there have been many revisions, improvements, and arguments regarding intelligence testing. I mean, is it intelligence based on a single factor, or are there such things as multiple intelligences? Okay, and is intelligence based on where you received your education, or what kind of education that you had received, or is it based on culture? Is it based on language? Is it based on blood type and all that other stuff? All that just came right into the mix as far as arguments and wanting to know which is the largest factor, most contributing factor when it comes to determining a person's intelligence. And so the most common argument was that there is much more to a person's intelligence than a single factor or measurement of intelligence. There's actually an intelligence test out there. I kid you not. I am not making this up. Okay? You can Google this if you don't believe me. But it was called the Chitlin's Test of Intelligence. Yeah, the Chitlin's Test of Intelligence. And it came out in 1968. And this test really looked at cultural intelligence. And it was designed to demonstrate differences in understanding and culture between races, and especially people in the North, North United States, and people in the Southern United States. Okay. And so look that up and see how you do on it. But again, if you have one test that is just looking at how much are you aware of your culture and just everyday language and the things that you take for granted and how food is prepared and things like that, well, if you scored high on that Chitlin's test of intelligence, then you have a high IQ. And as I said, it was one of the reasons why that test was developed, was just to like, hey, let's not forget about the cultural influences here when it comes to intelligence, I mean, because not everybody is afforded the formal higher levels of education. So that doesn't mean that people do not have intelligence. It's just their intelligences lie elsewhere. Well, one of the more popular intelligence tests that emerged later on after this Chitlin's test of intelligence came from Howard Gardner in the 1980s. And Gardner's test was based on multiple intelligences, eight of them to be exact, which included linguistic intelligence, or one has an aptitude for languages or reading and so forth. And then there was also logical or mathematical intelligence. Right? There was spatial intelligence, such as if you're good with maps or directional orientation. It also measured bodily or kinesthetic intelligence. And this is, you know, I would say that people who are very athletic would score very high in the bodily kinesthetic intelligence. Well, there's the musical intelligence, interpersonal intelligence, like how we interact with others, intrapersonal intelligence, where we get that introspection going on, and a naturalist intelligence. So these would be the people, I imagine, who appreciate just being outdoors. These are the people that you could probably find on the TV show Survivor, where you could just drop them off in the middle of nowhere and, okay, no problem. I'll see you in 2 days. And then they will find their way back to you. Okay. Some people just have that kind of intelligence where they can just navigate the land. They just have that about them. Well, since Gardner's time, we now have emotional intelligence, which was made famous, it's a household name, by Daniel Goleman and others, which ironically focuses on what's been termed as soft skills. Okay, and these soft skills are not like technical skills. Okay, the technical skills would be like computer skills or IT software or something of that nature, something where you would have to learn how to do something. You know, you would have this skill about you and so forth. But soft skills, on the other hand, is what Daniel Goleman and others focused on with their emotional intelligence. And these soft skills include interpersonal skills, or how we treat one another, basic decency, understanding, openness, and teachability. Okay. And over the years, there has been an interesting change in how Goleman's emotional intelligence has made its way into the workforce. And in fact, the emotional intelligence is often taught side by side with other theories when it comes to, like, say, career development. Okay, because nowadays, employers seem to be interested in hiring people with, yes, you know, the technical skills to do the job, but they also want people who possess emotional intelligence or these soft skills. In fact, I was just talking to one person who is just a career counselor. Just, you know, that's what he does. And, you know, he says that he meets with a lot of employers. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, the conversations often turn around with, you know, I could teach anybody a hard skill on, you know, or how to run a machine or a computer program, whatever. But what I can't teach them are the soft skills or the non-technical skills that relate how you work. Again, you know, these these skills, you know, relate to how you interact with your colleagues or how you solve problems and how you manage your work. And these have to be cultivated within. Okay, and the effects of emotional intelligence have been measured in various ways within the workforce, such as, a person with strong emotional intelligence will provide increased team performance. You know, if you're working on projects together in like small groups or teams, as well as improved decision making. Okay, and this was something that was picked up later by Google, who had done just a fascinating study on just what makes them effective or the teamwork, what makes the teamwork effective. And, they found out that it was something related to psychological safety in that people felt comfortable. People felt assured. People felt part of the team. They could offer their opinions. They could brainstorm without the fear of any repercussions of being fired or ridiculed or shame. And they had this tremendous understanding of, you know, I can be part of a team and I can really give my all if I have this psychological safety. So emotional intelligence certainly improved decision making. Well, emotional intelligence also goes a little bit further. You know, you also have this increased personal well-being. And they've also found that people with emotional intelligence, in the long run, there is a lot of reduction in the turnover of staff in general. Because the managers who have emotional intelligence, you know, they have the people skills. They want to check in on their staff and how are you doing and what can I do to help? And you know, wanted to make sure that their employees are happy and satisfied. And people who also have emotional intelligence have just a decrease of their occupational stress and an increase in leadership ability. So there's lots of benefits to emotional intelligence, and within Goleman's book entitled Emotional Intelligence, I believe he has a test you can take to determine just where you score on that. But let's take this in a different direction now. Let's ask ourselves this question. Can we measure spiritual intelligence objectively? Or in other words, with a pen and paper test? I mean, you know, some people would say, yeah, sure, you could do that. But many people say, no, I don't think so. It just doesn't fit. Okay. And is there a way to measure whether or not a person has the capacity for this spiritual intelligence? Or is it mainly trying to objectify something that we can't quite put our hands on? We know it when we have it. We know it when we don't. But as far as, you know, how do we measure that? Would it go according to how things have always been measured objectively? Or is there something deeper at play here? Okay. Well, spiritual intelligence has often been defined as this ability to access higher meanings or values or abiding purposes and unconscious aspects of yourself and to really embrace or embed these meanings and values and purposes in order to live happier, healthier, and more creative lives. Okay. So signs of, let's say, a high spiritual intelligence would include the ability to think outside the box or a strong sense of humility and an access to energies that come from something beyond the ego, beyond us and our day-to-day concerns. Well, that might be one way to put it, okay? For me, that definition, and I can only speak for myself here, that definition is just way too clinical or sterile, because I would rather place spiritual intelligence or spirituality in general within the relationships that, yes, also include an openness or a teachability. In the Oglala Lakota tradition, Frank's Fool's Crow, he lived around 1890 to about 1989, I believe. He taught that in order to become holy, that is, a person through whom the Great Spirit could work in and through to heal others and so forth, a person must first become like a hollow bone. Fool's Crow believed that people are not to seek transformation for their own power or their own honor, but instead to be this hollow bone or a pipeline that connects God, Wakantanka, and the people. And the process of becoming a hollow bone began when people started to ask Wakantanka to rid themselves of anything that would impede them in any way, such as doubt or ridiculous questions or selfishness or reluctance or pride or ego or anything like that. Okay, and as a result, this psycho-spiritually transformed person, as I would put it, would then need to see themselves as unobstructed, you know, this unobstructed conduit through whom God could work to be a blessing to others. And this hollow bone is a powerful symbol for emptying ourselves of everything that hinders and impedes the life of God's Spirit. Because as we were taught in biology class, you know, bones provide our bodies not only with our physical frame, but also within themselves, they contain marrow, or this flexible tissue, that is also responsible for producing blood, and which then supports our immune system. However, in understanding the concept of becoming a hollow bone, we have to first acknowledge our need to, metaphorically speaking, die to ourselves. Because when we think about it, a hollow bone is both dead in that it doesn't contain any blood or marrow, but yet at the same time, it is alive. It is alive because it is the Spirit of God flowing freely in and through us for the benefit of others. This act is not a one-time event. You know, being a hollow bone, it's an ongoing process of examining and letting go of ourselves in order to take hold of something better for the sake of humanity. We have to become empty in order to be filled. You see, God is speaking all the time, and part of my definition of spiritual intelligence is what's keeping us from hearing God's voice. And through either contemplation or meditation, we not only need to stop, our monkey mind or our mind's chatter, but also we need to open our hearts regarding how we see and listen for God. I mean, where do we see God in all things? Where do we see God in, the beauty of a sunrise or the different rays as the sun is going down at sunset? Do we focus on hearing God's voice in the cries and laughters of others? How do we feel when we are experiencing wind and rain? Do we hear God in the sound of owls and eagles and hawks? And similarly, should we not also look for God in the tears of a child or listen for the voice of God in every heartbreak or finding the voice of God that gives us voice in and through our losses? Well, despite our perceived differences in race and language and religion and culture, there's also this common Native American expression that emphasizes an interconnectedness among all that we see, namely Matakio Oyasin. All are related. This phrase is understood by the Lakota Sioux people as an expression extending to all of creation and everything, humanity, animals, vegetation, minerals, elements, land, water, thunder, fire, wind, sun, moon, stars, etc., are all connected to one another and affect one another. See, far too long, humanity, and just take a look at history on this one, far too long, humanity has been influenced by the what's in it for me kind of scenarios. And as much as we can become enthralled by our gifts and our giftedness, we also have to remember that our talents and our skills, our blessings, knowledge, and wisdom, those things are not for ourselves. These gifts exist in us for the benefit of somebody else. And reclaiming our authenticity then should compel us to now ask, well, how then can I serve humanity? How then can I alleviate suffering? How then can I speak up for those who do not have a voice? And this is what authenticity is really all about. You know, some people I've talked to, been around, say that they are content being just exactly as they are. Okay? But we need to ask ourselves, am I being authentic today? Am I being honest and genuine in my relationships? I mean, I hear from too many people that they would rather wait till they're retired, whenever that will be, okay, to do what they've always dreamed of doing. I mean, like, what are they waiting for? Having their bills paid? Having enough money in the bank? You see, it's too many people play the "I'll get around to it someday" game when vulnerable and wounded people are in need right now. And so such hurting people need others to see in them the potential to live authentically, including the benefit of reclaiming authenticity. And perhaps people believe that they have way too much to lose to be authentic. And perhaps they do not know or fear that people will not accept them as they are. Perhaps they have a fear of rejection or ridicule or shame or being ostracized or being shunned. But we live in a time when, as we focus on a virtue, and it is a virtue, of stewardship, the one gift that we need to foster and treasure is really the gift of ourself, our inner life, our spirit of resiliency, that sacred neutral in us. And there is great value in reclaiming our authenticity, because whenever we find that inner strength, whenever we find that freedom and peace and assurance of who we are without giving away our uniqueness, that is, by playing by somebody else's rules and definitions and expectations. And for some, finding their inner strength to stand on their own two feet further empowers them to reach out to others to be in better relationships or better jobs or a sense of justice. Indeed, you know, those who are authentic often find God's blessings in the tiniest details of life. And I believe this is where the next great spiritual awakening will come from, whenever we find a strength to reclaim our authenticity. Well, I would really love to hear your heart on this matter. So I invite you to call in and let's talk about the spiritual side of emotional intelligence. That number again is 888-627-6008. And I'll be taking your calls after the break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I'm your host, Dr. James Houck. I'll be back with you in 1 minute. Welcome back. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. I invite you to tune in next Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, noon Pacific Standard Time, when we are going to continue this conversation. This is going to be a part one and a part two. We're going to go a little bit deeper after today and go deep, deep, deep within the spiritual side of emotional intelligence or living in sacred neutral. So I invite you to tune in next Friday, 3 o'clock. Well, earlier in the show, we were talking about spiritual intelligence as an awareness that is placed in the heart and soul of relationships. And for me, the hollow bone is a very powerful symbol for emptying ourselves of everything that hinders and impedes the life of God's Spirit. You know, and as I mentioned, you know, in the first half, that as we were taught in biology class, you know, bones provide our bodies not only with our physical frame, protects organs and so forth, but also within themselves, you know, bones contain marrow or this flexible tissue that is also responsible for producing blood and supporting the immune system. And yet, in understanding the concept of how then do you become a hollow bone, we have to first acknowledge our need to, shall we say, die to ourselves. Let go of that ego. The ego just simply gets in the way, and pride and everything else. And ironically, when we think about a hollow bone, you know, a hollow bone is both dead in that it doesn't contain any blood or marrow, but yet at the same time, it is alive. Because it is the Spirit of God flowing freely in and through us as hollow bones for the benefit of others. And this act is not a one-time event. It's an ongoing process of examining ourselves and letting go of ourselves in order to take hold something better for the sake of others. Okay. Well, I would say, oh gosh, probably over the past 10 years or so, if not longer, there's been a lot of talk, and especially a lot of talk these days about reducing our carbon footprints, you know, and those conversations go from eliminating greenhouse gases and industrial emissions and the effects of mining to the global warming debate and conservation. Okay, and this goes back even further. I mean, 70s, 60s, 70s, 1960, 1970s, and then some. But yet, what I do not hear included in these conversations is how the damaging effects our carbon footprints clearly mimic the damaging effects our interpersonal footprints have on one another. See, today it's often considered the norm, and if not the expectation, that people will walk all over another person to lie, to cheat, to steal, and then expect these actions to have no psychological or spiritual or emotional consequences or even physical consequences. And if we assume this, we are certainly gravely mistaken. And as evidenced from our attitudes and actions, we've not learned from previous generations' discoveries and mistakes. I mean, we clearly do not possess the ancient wisdom that comes from recognizing those lessons of respect and dignity and value and gratitude passed on to us in the created order of things. Or, let's put it another way, it ought to be glaringly obvious that the way we treat our environmental resources and animals is a direct relation and a direct reflection of our attitudes and behaviors toward each other. Okay? In fact, despite all of our searching for, let's say, a psycho-spiritual wholeness or living in this sacred neutralness, we do not possess such wisdom because we do not understand how we are spiritually and emotionally fragmented. And yet it is from this understanding that we recognize the opportunity that is before us and has always been before us to heal these relationships with ourselves and others and the land. And if we have not invested time and authenticity in these relationships, we find ourselves as emotionally empty and spiritually emaciated as the land itself that has been stripped of its resources. Because, you know, sooner or later, we have to return to our daily routines after we have, like I would call, a mountaintop experience or these wonderful spiritual transformations. And we have to get back into the daily grind, as it were, and discover new ways of how now do we live out our psycho-spiritual transformative experience. And as much as we may have experienced this exhilarating psycho-spiritual transformation, the irony is that these life-changing moments are not for ourselves. Indeed, just as strong as the experience of psycho-spiritual transformation is, and being compelled to live in this sacred neutralness, we're then called to transcend such mountaintop experiences by getting beyond our self-serving attitudes or codependent behaviors or other things that just rob us from our spiritual energy, and embrace our mutually shared connection with one another. In other words, to begin this process by shifting our focus from what do I get out of this to how do I keep it, to how are we gifted to serve others? How can we live a life of authenticity that is life-giving to the emotional and physical and spiritual well-being of others and ourselves? And where does a transformation first take place in us? And exactly what is transformed? Are there certain times in our lives when we are more ripe for transformation? Or do we just happen to be at in the right place at the right time? And are we simply responding to God's call, you know, stirring our hearts and kind of nudging us along? Well, regardless of these questions, certainly being aware of God's Spirit in our lives always requires a response from us, or let's call it an act of faith, stepping out on faith. Because let us also keep in mind that ignoring God and indecisiveness to take the initial steps of this self-discovery is, well, that's also a response. And yes, the psycho-spiritual transformation is initiated by God, but it is also an intentional daily effort on our behalf. It's not a passive phenomenon. It requires an active participation on our part. Yes, transformation places us on a path, a journey to follow and embrace all of what God has in store for us. And yet, transformation also compels us then to transcend ourselves and our surroundings in order to, shall we say, fan the flames of the internal spiritual fire that has been sparked in us. And from the Christian perspective, a psycho-spiritual transformation is one that results in a life of service to others that follows the example of how Christ himself served and healed and redeemed humanity. But you know, many times the psycho-spiritual journey is often romanticized. I don't know if you've run into this, but I have several times, you know, where stories have been written or people have been shared. And it comes across as wonderful and exciting and, you know, no more hurdles and no more obstacles. And I get where that's coming from. I mean, I really do. But as romantic as being on this psycho-spiritual journey sounds, we will be faced with dangerous obstacles that block our way from the social context in which we live. In fact, not everybody is going to accept our spiritual journey with open arms. I mean, not everybody we encounter or attempt to serve or reach out to understands or will even trust, you know, our motives. But we are social beings, and we're going to have to contend with these cultural norms and rituals and expectations. And when these types of reactions occur, I think it's wise for us not to take society's response personally or discourage us from, let's say, future efforts. And the truth is that there are going to be times when our spiritual journey takes us beyond, let's say, social convention. I mean, it has to. And when we and others recognize this change, we are most fortunate. In fact, people who knew us before our transformation might even dismiss us, you know, believing that our new attitude is just a phase you're going through. You know, I liked you better when you were your old self. You know? But please keep in mind that many people are still living with this skeptical, what's the catch kind of perspective. They may be waiting for us to just simply get over it and return to the way we used to be. Come on, that's enough now. It's a phase. Let this go already. Come on, your friends miss you and all that other good stuff. Okay. Well, if that hasn't occurred to you already, and if people are simply waiting for us to get over it and go back to the way we used to be after a spiritual transformation, they're in for a long wait, okay? Because in response, do we ignore the stirrings of our hearts and simply turn our backs on society? Or can we understand that what has been transformed in us compels us then to not run from society, but then to re-engage society to heal the suffering of others? You see, a spiritual transformation doesn't send us to the mountains per se. It says, get back in there, go back into society and heal those who have yet to be able to find the strength to overcome, to heal, to find their voice, and so forth. Okay? Because undeniably, once we've been transformed, we're never going to look at life and others the same as we did before, because we're now looking at the world with an awakened soul. And we're going to discern every experience through the lens of the perspective of heaven. And as a result, all things in our lives undergo a transformation. You know, even work becomes a sense of a worshipful experience. So within every person, there, you know, in every person's journey to seek God, there is this ongoing call for authenticity. In other words, to be a hollow bone, to live in that sacred neutralness, we come as we are with no hidden agendas. Like, we can hide that from God, okay? No false pretenses, just simply, here I am, this is who I am. God has always responded to seekers who worship God with hearts that are truthful and spirits that are broken and longing for God's presence. And this act of worship naturally just flows out of a heartfelt spiritual desire to know God and to dwell in that everlasting holy presence. And it is this desire that compels us then to be genuine and authentic in our relationships with others. Indeed, worship is at the essence of the response of a heart that is just earnestly striving and crying out after the heart of God. And worship often flows out of the deep, wrenching hunger and thirst and this desire to know God, not intellectually, but within the heart and definitely within the soul. You know, not just to know God, but to dwell in God. To dwell in God's presence. Indeed, our transformation ultimately encourages us to recognize this capacity for, you know, our relatedness. So, you know, and such of a transformation is not limited to either the mind or the spirit, but it also encapsulates both. One time, Richard Rohr, who is the founding director, Father Richard Rohr, founding director of the Center for Action and Contemplation in Albuquerque, New Mexico, he states that a change of heart is always a change of mind. And both of those faculties have to undergo transformation for it to really take root and bear fruit in our lives. So I'm a firm believer that in order to sustain changes in our lives, it involves the courage to let go of the former familiar and allow the transformation of ourselves to unfold. Okay? People are more likely to transform and continue this transformation when they're committed to and involved with their own healing process. Okay, which in other words means we have to take an active or an integrative approach to unlearned, let's say, negative attitudes or old habits or inauthenticity, and yet at the same time committed to relearning or reclaiming our authenticity in life-giving ways that sustain the physical, emotional, and spiritual healing. And everybody who has experienced a touch of God in a radical, life-changing manner always wants more. They always want to experience more of God. It just touches off this hunger that this is what I've been looking for. This is what my heart has been crying out for. This is what my soul has been aching for. And I want more of it. Whatever the spiritual experience was at the time, that tiny spark of God's Spirit often ignites this unquenchable flame in us to desire more and more of the Spirit of God. And then, once we do, the task then is for us to fan the flames into a change in behaviors and mindset and devotion to God, and just to express humility in our relationships with, again, ourselves, others, and God. Okay. But still, many people often wonder, why is this psychosocial, spiritual transformation, why does it have to be painful at times? Well, the answer is simple, but the implications are profound. Because perhaps the reason why we experience difficulty during our, let's say, psycho-spiritual transformation is that we do not often allow ourselves enough time to sit with it. We don't allow enough time to discern, let alone integrate what's happened to us. We just want to rush right out, just like, okay, headlong into doing something instead of just sitting with what has happened in us. Let it just allow it to integrate. Just allow it to sit with us. And for the most part, this integration is a lifelong process of living out, this authentic self in the world. But yet, that doesn't mean that there aren't practical things we can do following, let's say, the divine encounters. We'd spend time in prayer, hours in prayer, or spiritual ceremonies, or contemplating and experiencing that touch of God. And we may feel as though we are floating somewhere in the universe, but before our spiritual feet are back on the ground, we might want to rush right back into the daily routine. And little do we realize, as I said, we might be doing more harm than good. Okay. And spiritual work, especially on this level, has the potential to be physically and emotionally, psychologically draining. It is exhausting. And this is why self-care is a must. We have to allow ourselves time to rest and reflect and recharge. And some people who are physically exhausted need to sleep. Other people need time to process just what exactly shifted in me. And some people share a simple meal in order to further digest, as you will, the wisdom and insights that they may have encountered. So as a result of the experience, self-care is essential. People have been, down through history, I should say it this way, people have had enough of being used and abused in their lives to know when somebody is acting not being authentic with them, when somebody is acting with ulterior motives. But when genuineness is displayed, relationships then take on a powerful bond that weathers the most sensitive feelings of vulnerability. And recognizing and valuing what people have to offer, Roni strengthens this bond. So I'd like to end this broadcast with sharing with you the Motaki Oesen prayer. It says, Aho, Motaki Oesen, all my relations, I honor you in this circle of life with me today. I am grateful for this opportunity to acknowledge you in prayer. To the Creator, for the ultimate gift of life, I thank you. To the mineral nation that has built and maintained my bones and all the foundations of life, I thank you. To the plant nation that sustains my organs and body and gives me healing herbs for sickness, I thank you. To the animal nation that feeds me from your own flesh and offers your loyal companionship in this walk of life, I thank you. To the human nation that shares my path as a soul upon a sacred wheel of earthly life, I thank you. To the spirit nation that guides me invisibly through the ups and downs of life and for carrying the torch of light through the ages, I thank you. To the four winds of change and growth, I thank you. You are all my relations, my relatives, without whom I would not live. We are in the circle of life together, coexisting, codependent, co-creating our destiny. One not more important than the other, one nation evolving from the other, and yet each dependent upon the one above and the one below. All of us a part of the great mystery. Thank you for this life. Well, I'm Dr. James Houck, and you have been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Please be safe. And until we speak again next week, be well. Everybody behave yourselves. And please continue reaching out to find the most authentic parts of you. Bye-bye.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding to buy a book by Dr. Houck, it's all there. Just wander on over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Friday at noon Pacific Time on PBS Radio TV.